Good evening. Welcome. Before we begin, please remember to silence or turn off cell phones. This is really a privilege for me. I mean, it's part of an ongoing series of book talks that we here at the JTS Library sponsor over the course of the year. And those talks may relate to the publications of faculty members, it may be others in the JTS community, or just simply significant Jewish books that are being published that we want to bring to the attention of the public. This evening I have the privilege of introducing an old friend and colleague, Richard Kalman. We had the privilege and pleasure of being students together in Dr. David Halivni's Talmud seminar when he was still professor here, and he was each of us, our PhD advisors. So we had a lot of common experience. Most of it pleasurable, I think it's fair to say.
and you can hear more of that afterwards.
Yeah. But in any case, since that time, Richard has had a very distinguished career, very productive. Those of you who are here, I'm sure, know the record of his work in publications, which have been very influential. And his latest book, I mean, you know why you're here, so I could read the title to you, but you already know the title. His latest book is an extension of Richard's work, but it's also an extension of a field that has really come to be central to the study of rabbinics in late antiquity. It's fair to say, I think, that there is a school of scholars whose attention is addressed more than anything else to the narratives of the Talmud, and Richard's work makes very considerable contributions to that in using narrative to suggest possible historical lessons. In this particular case, he's doing not only that by itself would be a significant contribution, but he's actually asking us to slow down, to sit back, and to consider an alternative perspective. Those of you who are in the field know that very influential in recent years has been the orientation which asks us to look at the parallels between the Babylonian Talmud, or the Persian Talmud, if you prefer, and the religious culture of Persia in which the rabbis who produced this document found themselves, in a way that is both a little bit startling in the best sense of the term, and masterful. Richard says in this book, not so fast. Don't forget about the important influence of the Eastern Roman Empire. That is where we begin. I assume he will address that and other things, and so you're here to listen to him, not to me. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Okay, there's a lot to balance on this little podium, so I'll try to do the best I can.
Use this if you need to.
Okay. All right. You should have the map in front of you. That's going to be very important, and I hope we'll make it easier for you to follow what it is I'm talking about. My book argues that a significant cultural change can be seen in 4th century and later Babylonia. And when we talk about Babylonia, we're talking about, you see Iraq, and it kind of in the middle of the map, and the two rivers that go centrally through that, that's where Babylonia is. And that, as David said, is the western part of the Persian Empire. But anyway, I think that a significant cultural change can be seen in 4th century and later Babylonia due to the incorporation into the Babylonian Talmud, otherwise known as the Bavli, the incorporation of non-rabbinic and even non-Jewish traditions from the Eastern Roman provinces, as well as traditions deriving from Christian and pagan cultures east of Syria. So again, to invoke the map, when I talk about the Eastern Roman provinces, I have in mind Egypt, I have in mind Israel, I have Syria in mind, and also Asia Minor, things like that. And the Christians in Mesopotamia are also important for my discussion, and they are to the north of the rabbis, again in Iraq, a modern day Iraq. The textual analyses that I offered throughout the book support the thesis that it is critically important to study the Bavli in light of multiple cultural contexts, particularly the eastern provinces of the Roman Empire. The importance of Roman culture in Babylonia during this period, I would say, is the book's most important contribution. And when I talk about the Roman Empire, I'm not talking about Rome in Italy. I'm talking about the Eastern Roman provinces that I just mentioned, which are a good deal geographically closer to the Babylonian rabbis, but there's still a big cultural gap and a big geographical gap. My book focuses in detail on several rich narratives, or to be more precise, on several passages and motifs, most of them clearly of non-rabbinic and even non-Jewish origin, which are first attested in the Bavli by the latest Babylonian rabbis. I confine the discussion to parallel words, motifs, and clusters of motifs, that is, to very specific narrative details. And I'll be giving you an example of that in a little while, rather than to more general patterns that could be dismissed as the result of coincidence or as the result, for example, of the incorporation of common folk motifs rather than any direct historical contact. The commonalities that I observed between the Bavli and the literature of other cultures very likely is attributable to the intermingling of cultures, to the appropriation of aspects of one literature by a contemporaneous literature via historical context. In other words, other factors that aren't the result of historical context. My book raises several, I think, significant historical questions. First, when one finds a parallel between Persian literature and the Bavli, for example, is one's work over, or has one's work just begun? My book argues that one's work has just begun. If that sounds obvious, it increasingly, as David mentioned, has not been so obvious in the field, because people have been focusing on Persia to great extent. I'm not implying that Persia is unimportant. I'm just saying that we have to, as David said, slow down. One must examine whether the parallel is symptomatic of a special relationship between the two cultures where you find the parallel, or is it symptomatic, for example, of late antiquity in general? When I'm talking about late antiquity, so the period that I'm talking about here is roughly from the 3rd to the 7th or 8th centuries. Okay? And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to interrupt me. Second, what are we to conclude when traditions attributed to a Palestinian rabbi in the Bavli are unparalleled by traditions preserved in Palestinian rabbinic corpora? So in other words, you have a statement attributed to Rabbi Yochanan in the Bavli. Okay, Rabbi Yochanan is the quintessential rabbi from the land of Israel. Okay, and yet we find very often that statements found in the Bavli are not paralleled in the Yerushalmi, for example, the Palestinian Talmud. So how are we supposed to treat material like that? Are to we assume that the traditions in the Bavli are Babylonian, okay, that they're Babylonian rabbinic inventions, in other words, that they falsely attributed it to a prominent Palestinian rabbi, or is it equally plausible that they derive from the Roman East and tell us about provincial Roman culture. I argue that both conclusions are possible, in contrast to scholars who conclude without further ado that such materials must be the products of Babylonian rabbinic culture. So in other words, I'm arguing that we don't know necessarily enough about Babylonian rabbinic culture or about Persian culture than we think we do when we're studying the Babylonian Talmud, since so much comes in from the Eastern Roman provinces. Third, the conclusions of this book force us to speculate about how traditions traveled from one locality to the other, from the Roman East to Babylonia, and why the geographically relatively distant Roman Empire contributed so much to rabbinic Babylonia. I suggested one possibility: the periodic wars of conquest of the Persians deep into Roman territory, and the resettlement of Jewish, Christian, and pagan populations from that area in Mesopotamia, eastern Syria, and western Persia. But perhaps other explanations are equally plausible, and maybe you can come up with one for me. Fourth, perhaps the conclusions of my book shed light on the much-debated question of the extent to which Persian culture appropriated from Greek and Roman culture rather than vice versa, since each of the literary studies in the book concluded that traditions traveled from the Roman East to Mesopotamia, and only subsequently to Persia. In other words, they're going in this direction from the Roman East, which is actually the West vis-a-vis the rabbis, the Babylonian rabbis, rather than going the opposite direction. Okay? This finding does not please people who demand political correctness in scholarship, since it smacks of Orientalism and an apologetic argument in favor of Western supremacy over the benighted East. So in other words, what I happened to find in each of the studies that I undertook was that the literature was going from the West, relatively speaking, the West, the Roman East, all right, that's very confusing, I know, to Persia. It went in that direction rather than vice versa. Persia wasn't contributing as much to the Roman Empire, okay? And I know that there's certainly exceptions. I'm well aware of that, but I'm just telling you what I found in my research. In addition, the role of Persian literature in the development of the Babylonian rabbinic stories examined in my study was not extensive, and the Persian versions of these texts were almost without exception late and derivative. While the cultural connection between Persia and the Bavli is real and extremely important, I found few traces of it in the material I examined. Perhaps this fact suggests that the role of Persia in the formation of the Bavli is not as all-pervasive as some of its most enthusiastic proponents would have us believe. Okay. You have a question?
No.
All right. Okay. In the remainder of my time, I'd like to examine with you ancient versions of the legend of the martyrdom of Isaiah. I argue by focusing in detail on this one case that, one, the mid-4th century began a period of intensive Eastern provincial Romanization of Jewish Babylonia, and two, that Babylonia became part of the emerging cultural unity that was beginning to form in Palestine, Syria, Mesopotamia, and Western Persia until the Islamic conquests drastically altered the political and cultural landscape. So on the one hand, I think I'm trying to show, and I think I showed somewhat successfully, that Babylonia was part of the Mediterranean world on the one hand, which people kind of found individual cases of it, but nobody put it all together to see the actual scope of the phenomenon, and also that this area in here, from Palestine to Babylonia, is becoming more and more similar, even though it never reaches full unity. Yeah?
When you talk about similarity or unity, was there a dominant language in that area?
There was a dominant language in that area. It was I would say it was Syriac, and then there was also a development of Arabic, but more to the south, but it came north. But Arabic really gets going as a written language later. Okay. In addition, I argue that Christian sources attest the same development as the Jewish sources do, in the same part of the world and at approximately the same time, indicating a significant linkage between the Jewish and Christian communities in Mesopotamia in late antiquity. And this example, I hope, is going to show that, how the Jews and Christians, at least in this one respect, at least in this one case, are really heavily implicated within each other. So close is the linkage in this one case that a story told in a Syriac Christian source, and Syriac is a form of Aramaic used by primarily by Christians. So a story told in a Syriac Christian source holds the key to the interpretation of a Babylonian rabbinic story, since the two stories utilize the same constellations of motifs and themes to teach strikingly similar lessons. This commonality between the Jews and the Christians does not necessarily indicate that the rabbis borrowed these motifs from the Mesopotamian Christians or vice versa, although neither possibility is out of the question. Rather, it is one small but significant demonstration that the literature of the two groups, the Jews and Christians, formed part of a common cultural sphere, although the differences between the motifs and how they are used are potentially as interesting as the similarities. I approach these issues via examination of the Babylonian Talmudic story of Menashe's execution of Isaiah. Okay, so this is a rabbinic story about biblical characters. Okay, so don't get confused by the fact that Isaiah and Menashe and Moses figure in these stories. It's a rabbinic story dealing with characters in the Bible. Okay, and I examine this story against the background of Christian and Jewish literature from the 1st to the 7th centuries. I'm going to abbreviate it a little bit for the talk tonight. The Bavli's version of the tradition depicts Moses as superior to the prophet Isaiah in response to other ancient depictions, notably by Christians, of Isaiah as Moses' superior. In addition, the Bavli's version of the tradition perhaps uses Isaiah, in Hebrew Yeshayahu, as a stand-in for Jesus, in Hebrew Yeshua. So even though the story is talking about Isaiah, a biblical character, I suggest that the rabbis actually have Jesus in mind, who of course is not an Old Testament character, not a Hebrew biblical character. Okay, so I argue that this story depicts Isaiah as executed according to God's will with the aid of a tree. Okay. Tree, that was a, in other words, that, if I'm correct, stands for the crucifixion, for the crime of casting aspersions on the Jewish people. In evaluating this hypothesis, it's important to bear in mind that ancient Christians attempting to prove Jesus' messianic status quoted Isaiah's prophecies more frequently than those of any other biblical prophet. So I think that the authors of this story are expressing a little bit of exasperation with Isaiah for constantly ragging on the Jewish people. It is even more important to bear in mind that the biblical words formed from the Hebrew root Yud Shin Ayin, the basic components of Isaiah's Hebrew name, were routinely interpreted by the early church fathers, including church fathers who flourished in Palestine, in the rabbi's backyard, the Eretz Yisraeli rabbis, the Palestinian rabbis, as references to the Christian Messiah. So in other words, whenever they found a word with a root Yud Shin Ayin, these Christian fathers, early fathers, would interpret that as a reference somehow to the Christian Messiah. Also striking is the fact that Origen and Jerome, church fathers who flourished in Palestine, attributed precisely such a scriptural interpretation to a Jewish Christian and a semi-Christian. And if the claims of these church fathers are reliable, we can easily understand how the Babylonian rabbis would have had access to them. It is therefore not at all surprising that the rabbis should have viewed Isaiah as a stand-in for Jesus. Okay, so now on to the first text, which is the one in the handout, number one. It's taken from the Ascension of Isaiah, a pseudepigraphic Christian book entitled The Ascension of Isaiah, describes Menashe's execution of Isaiah and relates the reasons for his execution. Okay, it begins as follows, and now you can follow along, I hope. Isaiah said to Hezekiah the king and Samael Malkira, that is Satan, will serve Menashe and will do everything he wishes. And Menashe will be a follower of Beliar. That's at least according to the translation that I, and commentator that I used for this. That's another name for Satan. And one of the peculiar things about this book is it has lots of different names for the devil. Okay, anyway, Menashe will be a follower of Beliar rather than of me. This is Isaiah talking. He will cause many in Jerusalem and Judah to desert the true faith, and Beliar will dwell in Menashe, and by his hands I will be sawn in half. Okay. Then, the next part from the Ascension of Isaiah, Ascension 3, verses 6 through 10, and Belkira, a Samaritan false prophet, accused Isaiah and the prophets who were with him, saying, Isaiah and the prophets who are with him prophesy against Jerusalem and against the cities of Judah, that they will be laid waste, and also against Benjamin, that it will go into captivity, and also against you, O Lord King, that you will go bound with hooks and chains of iron. So this is calculated to get Menashe good and mad. But they prophesy lies against Israel and Judah. And Isaiah himself has said, I see more than Moses the prophet. Moses said, there is no man who can see the Lord and live. And that's a quotation from Exodus chapter 33, verse 20. But Isaiah himself has said, I have seen the Lord, and behold, I am alive. Okay, and that's a quotation from Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1. So on the one hand, Moses says, you can't see God. I can't see God. On the other hand, Isaiah claims to have seen God. So Isaiah's claiming to be greater than Moses. And he has called Jerusalem Sodom and the princes of Judah and Jerusalem, he has declared to be the people of Gomorrah. We cannot be sure when and where the story of Menashe's murder of Isaiah originated, but the earliest attestation of it is evidently in the Ascension of Isaiah. Most scholars today believe this book was authored in Western Syria or Palestine in the late 1st or early 2nd century CE. Apparently, therefore, the legend of Menashe's murder of Isaiah originated in the eastern provinces of the Roman Empire. That seems to be where it gets its start. A conclusion supported by the fact that crucial aspects of the legend are also attested by several 2nd and 3rd century church fathers from the Greek and Roman world. And we'll get a quotation from one of them in a little while. These facts are crucial for establishing my claim that the legend originated in the Roman East and traveled there from there to Mesopotamia and then later to Persia in subsequent centuries. Yeah?
Do these stories have anything to do, like in the historical era they were written in with Deutero Isaiah?
You mean the story that I'm quoting from now?
Yeah.
No. They don't know about that theory, if that's what you're asking. Okay. All right, the most extensive rabbinic parallel to the Ascension's legend of Menashe's execution of Isaiah is in the Babylonian Talmud, in Yevamot 49b to 58, and that should be number 3 on your handout. A Tana recited, an early rabbi recited, Shimon ben Azai says, actually this is probably just a repeater, okay, somebody whose job it was to, a professional repeater, so that they could be a little bit later, but that doesn't matter. Shimon ben Azai says, I found a scroll of genealogical records in Jerusalem, and in it was written, Menashe killed Isaiah. Said Rava, he judged him and killed him. Menashe said to Isaiah, Moses, your rabbi, said, for man might, may not see me and live, but you said, I saw the Lord seated on a high and lofty throne. So in other words, there you have exactly the same charge that's leveled against Isaiah in the ascension of Isaiah. You see it right here in the Bavli, and it's nowhere else in any other Jewish source. Moses, your rabbi, said, for what great nation is there that has a God so close at hand as is the Lord our God whenever we call upon him? But you said, seek the Lord while he can be found. So in other words, again, Isaiah contradicts Moses. Moses is saying that God, our God, is available to us whenever, and you say, no, he's only available at certain times, so you better grab him when you can. Moses, your rabbi, said, I will let you enjoy the full count of your days, but you said, and I will add 15 days to your life.
Okay. Years.
15 years to your life.
15
right.
days, not so
Yes, 15 years to your life. Okay. thank you. Said Isaiah, I know that he, Menashe, will not accept whatever I say to him. If I say, that is, respond to him, I will make him an intentional murderer. Isaiah said God's name and was swallowed by a cedar tree. The corner of his blue fringe remained outside. In other words, he was wearing tzitzit, of course, and he had a blue fringe, and that blue fringe remained visible. They brought the cedar tree, and they sought it. When they reached Isaiah's mouth, he died, because Isaiah said, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yeah?
Yeah, you said they when he said with he. Now, is the he a reference to Menashe?
Let's see. Because they brought the cedar tree?
And they sought it when he reached Isaiah's mouth. Now, I don't know if that's correct or not, if it's he or they.
Oh, this says you have he?
Yeah.
I'm actually not sure which is correct.
Because my question would be, is it meant to be Menashe?
It's probably they, probably, because it doesn't, you know, I doubt the king actually did this himself.
Okay.
Probably had his lackeys do it. Nevertheless, the verses cited in part C contradict one another. You see part C? Okay. I saw the Lord, as it is taught in an early rabbinic tradition. All of the prophets looked in a speculum that does not shine. Moses, our rabbi, looked in a speculum that shines. So in other words, that's the way around this seeming contradiction. This is what could have been said, what Isaiah could have said in answer to the accusations leveled against him by Menashe. So in other words, Moses, who looked through a clear glass, was not able to look directly on God. Okay, Isaiah, however, who looked through a dirty glass, he was able to look directly at God because he couldn't really see God. Okay, because it was a very, very bad image. Okay, what is the relationship between the Bavlis and the ascension of Isaiah's portrayal of Menashe's execution of Isaiah? Certainly the authors of the Ascension and Bavli Yevamot respond in part to biblical and Second Temple texts, but it is no less certain that either the Babylonian rabbis drew upon the traditions preserved in the Ascension, or both the Bavli and the Ascension drew upon a common fund of pre-existing source material. Suffice it to say, for the moment, that the Bavli's and the Ascension's accounts differ in significant respects, but they are also quite similar in important respects. The most obvious similarity between the accounts is the depiction of Menashe killing Isaiah by sawing him in half. Equally significant, however, is the fact that the Ascension and the Bavli depict the execution as a result of specific accusations by Menashe against Isaiah, one of which is identical in the two accounts. And, you know, this business of Isaiah claiming to see more than Moses was able to see. According to the Ascension, no less than according to the Bavli, therefore, it is appropriate to say that Menashe judged Isaiah and killed him, although these exact words are recorded only in the Bavli's account. Okay, Rava, the mid-4th century Babylonian rabbi who authored the statement, Menashe judged Isaiah and killed him, clearly knows at least some of the material that the Bavli shares in common with the Ascension. But it's not exactly sure how much, and it really is not so important. The important fact for me is that the Bavli has these similarities, or more than similarities, they're identical features that aren't found in any other Jewish text. Okay? All right. And so I mentioned before my claim that the legend originated in the Roman East. Okay, and one of the proofs was the fact that the Ascension of Isaiah is a very early work that that knows it. Okay, also the fact that Origen, who is a 3rd century church father from Palestine, also knows the basic facts about this. And number 4 in your handout. They say that Isaiah was cut apart by the people as one who depraved the law and spoke beyond what Scripture authored. For Scripture says, "No one shall see my face and live." But he says, "I saw the Lord of hosts." Moses, they say, saw him not, and you saw him. And for this reason, for this cause, they cut him apart and condemned him as impious. So you can see that says the same thing as well. Rava's claim that Menashe judged Isaiah and killed him, and together with the accusations against Isaiah that follow, comprise a surprisingly sympathetic, or at least ambiguous, portrayal of Menashe. Usually Menashe is portrayed by the rabbis as a wicked person. But this story, I'm arguing, is a little bit different. And where did they get that from? In the text that's not before you, Mishnah Sanhedrin contains an early rabbinic dispute about whether or not Menashe fully repented and thereby inherited a portion in the world to come. This story, I think, might reflect the opinion that the king did repent. Contributing to this sympathetic portrayal of Menashe is the fact that Bavli Yevamot portrays Menashe as innocent of murder, since Isaiah deliberately says nothing in response to Menashe's charges. Menashe's objections against Isaiah are serious and demand a response, however, as indicated by the fact that the Bavli's anonymous editors, parts F and G, feel the need to respond to them. Okay, those are really good problems. Okay, so as far as Menashe's doing, as far as Menashe knows, it's appropriate to put Isaiah to death for being a heretic. Isaiah, in part D, definitely presupposes a less than fully repentant Menashe, since Isaiah is certain that Menashe will not listen to reason and will kill him even if he satisfactorily responds to his objections, and will thereby be rendered an intentional murderer. But the fact that Isaiah expresses this certainty does not guarantee that he is correct. And in the next part of the discussion, I'm going to argue that the author of the story in the Bavli probably does not share Isaiah's clearly negative opinion of the king. Support for this interpretation emerges when we examine the importance in the story of motifs of speech and the mouth. Everything that happens in the story is effectuated through speech, casting doubt on Isaiah's claim that nothing he would have said would have had any effect on Menashe. After all, his words in this story have all kinds of effects. He says God's name, which causes him to be swallowed by a tree, although the fringes of his garment are showing, revealing his hiding place, suggesting that God wants Isaiah to receive his just deserts, that is, his punishment for having insulted the Israelites. In addition, another thing that Isaiah's saying accomplishes He says, I live among a people of unclean lips, which is the sin for which he is punished with death. And his death is via the mouth. Remember, when the saw reaches the mouth, that's when he's killed. He said things that appear to contradict what Moses said, which gets him into trouble with the king and causes his death. And as a prophet, when he says God's word, he puts it into effect. Perhaps Isaiah is punished not only because of what he said, but also because of what he refrained from saying, namely, why his, Isaiah's, words do not contradict those of Moses. In addition, when Isaiah says that he chooses to die rather than to make the king guilty of premeditated murder, perhaps we, the audience, are meant to be unsympathetic, in line with the rabbi's tendency in the Bavli to view with suspicion those who prefer martyrdom to escaping with their lives by means of a subterfuge. In other words, perhaps our initial reaction when we read that Isaiah says, I'm going to martyr myself rather than make the king of an intentional murder. We might want to view that as heroism, but normally in the Bavli, it's considered to be more praiseworthy to talk your way out of a situation, okay, avoid death rather than to rather than to suffer martyrdom. Okay. Also, so in other words, I'm trying to make the case against Isaiah and more in favor of Menashe. Also, of critical importance for understanding the Bavli story is the Syriac Acts of Sharbeel, probably written in the 4th or 5th century in Edessa, a city in northwestern Mesopotamia, not far from the Babylonian rabbis. And I think that's number 5 on your handout, hopefully. Okay. In this Christian text, like the Bavli's text, we find the motifs of the hero judged and executed by being sawn in two. We also find the hero's death coming about because of a crime of speech, and the crucial importance of the hero's mouth in his measure-for-measure punishment. Okay, so remember, Isaiah was punished measure for measure. He said something that was really insulting about the Israelites, so he died when the saw reached his mouth. Okay, and also he died because of something that he said. And similarly, we'll see that in the Christian text, there's the same measure-for-measure type of punishment. Okay, so here's the Sharbeel text. The judge cried aloud and said, as regards this Sharbeel, who was formerly priest of the gods, but has turned this day and renounced the gods, and has cried aloud, I am a Christian, and has not trembled at the gods, but has insulted them, I give sentence that a strap be thrust into the mouth of the insulter, as into the mouth of a murderer, and that he be sawn with a saw of wood, and that, when he is near to die, then his head be taken off with the sword of the executioner. Sorry about this. All right, then the narrator continues, and at the same moment the strap was suddenly thrust into his mouth, and the executioner seized him. They brought carpenter's instruments and thrust him into a wooden vise and tightened it upon him until the bones of his joints creaked with the pressure. Then they put upon him a saw of iron and began sawing him asunder. And when he was just about to die, because the saw had reached his mouth, they struck him with the sword and took off his head while he was still squeezed down in the vise. Yeah. Rough stuff. In the Bavli story, the protagonist dies when they reach his mouth. And in the story of Sharbeel, the executioners lop off his head when they reach his mouth. So the motif does not play out exactly the same in the two contexts. But in both narratives, the point is that the protagonist's mouth plays a crucial role in the crime that leads to his execution and in the working out of that execution. Okay. By the way, there's a picture from the Middle Ages of illustrating that grotesque scene of Isaiah getting sawed in half with lots of blood. In the Christian Sharbeel tale, the executioners make the point that their victim's crime was that of insulting the gods by crying aloud, I am a Christian, the standard climax of Christian accounts of late antique martyrology trials. So it's measure for measure. In other words, his crime is the crime in the eyes of the wicked executioners. His crime is saying, I am a Christian, and he dies really as punishment, but it's not divine measure for measure. This is measure for measure from a human point of view. He dies when the sword reaches his mouth. In the story of Isaiah's martyrdom in the Bavli, in contrast, the critical role of the mouth in the death of the martyr is not a sign of his saintliness and heroism, but rather a symbol of the sin he committed for which he is punished by God. While the precise relationship between the Christian and the rabbinic stories is difficult to determine at present, not to mention the fact that we're talking about different characters, so it's not exactly the same, the centrality of motifs of speech in the mouth in the Sharbiel tale supports my claim that these motifs are an important key to the meaning of the Bavli story as well. Okay, so it appears to be not just something I made up, you know, like sound it, a nice homily. It seems like that's really what the author intended. One might be inclined to see in Bavli Yevamot's high opinion of Moses and surprisingly low, or at least ambivalent, opinion of Isaiah, an attempt to deliver the message that the power of the rabbi, Moses, is greater than that of the prophet, Isaiah. When we examine the passage more closely, however, we see that this explanation is unsatisfactory. First, Isaiah apparently knows how to answer Menashe's objections. He just refrained from doing so. And as Menashe says, Moses is Isaiah's Rav, apparently proof that Isaiah is also a rabbi. So the operative distinction, I would argue, is not rabbis versus prophets, but the specific figure of Moses, who is both a rabbi and a prophet, versus the specific figure of Isaiah, also both a rabbi and a prophet. And Isaiah is probably viewed as superior to all other non-Mosaic prophets. Isaiah is Moses' inferior as a prophet. Moses saw clearly, according to the Bavli. Isaiah is Moses' inferior as a prophet. Moses saw clearly. Isaiah and other prophets did not. And Isaiah condemned the Israelites, and Moses apparently did not. Isaiah is also lacking as a rabbi. Isaiah did not respond to the objections posed by the king, even though the situation demanded a response. And it is a rabbi's stock in trade to respond to difficulties when traditions contradict. Presumably, this discussion is directed against those rabbis and non-rabbis, Jews and non-Jews, who favored Isaiah and other prophets over Moses himself. The ascension of Isaiah clearly favored Isaiah over Moses. According to the ascension of Isaiah, Isaiah had visions of Christ, the seven heavens, the incarnation of Christ, and his resurrection. And therefore, Isaiah clearly saw more than Moses. Even if we do not claim that there was direct dependence of the Bavli upon the ascension of Isaiah, the ascension gives us a good idea of the kinds of traditions and cultural tensions that provided the background of the Bavli's discussion. To conclude, analysis of the ancient and medieval traditions of Menashe's execution of Isaiah reveal a basic chronological and geographical picture, such that it is possible to state in general terms that the chronological record of the various versions of the traditions are earlier in the Roman East than in Mesopotamia and Persia. The ascension of Isaiah appears to have been composed in Palestine in the late 1st or early 2nd century CE. The 2nd and 3rd century church fathers, Justin, Tertullian, and Origen, attest crucially important aspects of the tradition, and they all derive from the Greek and Roman world. So that's to the left on your map, okay, where it says Syria, Palestine, Egypt, Turkey, etc. Okay. The Bavli and the Acts of Sharbiel, moving eastward to Iraq, they attest many of the same motifs at approximately the same time and in the same part of the world, namely the 4th or 5th century CE in Mesopotamia. The Persian compilations, which I didn't go over with you, that contain the tradition, the history of King Jamshid and the demon, Tabari and the Shahnameh, all date from approximately the 9th to the 11th centuries. So those are further east than Iraq. All of these facts make it likely that the tradition traveled from the Roman East to Mesopotamia and Persia from the 1st to the 11th century. So therefore, examination of the travels of a cluster of literary motifs is one of a growing number of proofs that Babylonia became part of an emerging but never fully realized cultural unity that was gradually forming in Palestine, Syria, Mesopotamia, and Western Persia, beginning in 4th century CE, and also that Babylonia increasingly became part of the Eastern provincial Roman world at this time. Thank you. Yes?
I have a question and a comment.
Mm-hmm.
The comment is in the Acts of Charbel, I thought it was really interesting, and it must be in your book also, about the value of wooden vice, which mm-hmm. is parallel to the tree.
Uh-huh.
So the wooden motifs of the time mm-hmm. are losing the Christological meaning of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you started off.
Well, except that he is a martyr, he's a Christian martyr. So, and all of the many of the Christian martyrs, in the stories told about them, they behave like Jesus. You know, they die on the same day that Jesus died, etc. You know, the same way in which Jesus died.
So to pick up on that and to build on where you started with the root of Yesha,
mm-hmm.
what does Charbel mean in Syria?
Charbel. I don't know what it means.
If it were related, that would be
yeah,
cool.
that would be cool, right? For the next edition, I'll look for it. Yeah.
Couple thoughts. The first actually is a question. When you were talking about Charbel, he died at the hands of men.
Mm-hmm.
But in reference to Isaiah, you said by the these aren't the exact words.
In other words, God was...
But it was Menashe who was
right.
doing it.
Yeah, Menashe was the agent, acting, you know, unwitting agent of God.
Oh, I see. Okay. But
okay? In other words, God wanted Isaiah to die, okay, right. because of his crime of calling the Israelites bad people, okay, that they...
And they, also his superseding the authority, mm-hmm. if you will,
mm-hmm.
of Menashe.
Right.
The other thought that crossed my mind, but which may... When you're talking about the influences spreading from the Eastern Roman Empire
mm-hmm.
eastward,
mm-hmm.
I had to think.
Yes, right.
You know, I keep thinking about that whole area really was a turmoil of activity in many, many, many respects. Now, I'm not sure, when was Alexander alive?
He's like the 4th century BCE.
BCE, because,
right.
you know, I'm not saying it's a direct part of it, but again, it's a force that was started either before or at that time where, again, he's moving
mm-hmm.
eastward.
Mm-hmm.
He's whatever his troops bring, whatever he brings,
mm-hmm.
it's an opening up to that eastern world,
mm-hmm.
what's out of the west.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is also the terminal of activity is, I'm not sure the exact year, I never do remember, sorry, but there was a schism between the Eastern and Western Catholic churches.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's the right reference.
No, that's true.
And that was much earlier than the Christian Reformation. You know, and that's, I think, again, what I call that part and parcel of dynamic activity that's going on at the time.
Right, well, the Persian church and, you know, even... To the west of the Persian Church, they took advantage of the fact that they were in a different empire to declare their independence of the Byzantines. Yeah.
But I mean that split there, and then mm-hmm. I guess you're saying further along eastward.
Right. Yeah, but again, I want to emphasize that it's not always the case that it goes from west to east. I mean, for example, Manichaeism. Which was a very popular religion in the 4th century. That started in Persia and then,
right. and then
got west very west. Popular in the Roman Empire.
But that makes sense. It's the intermingling. You can't say how it's going to drift, but the fact that it drifts in any direction is almost logical.
Mm-hmm.
It has to.
Yeah, yeah. Yes?
I'd just like to mention that Chronicles actually rehabilitates
mm-hmm.
Menashe
right.
because it says after 20 years
right.
He was taken to Babylonia and mm-hmm. returned, and there's the Menashe too.
Right. Yeah, that's the basis
the
for
it. So in a sense, you know, the attitude, positive attitudes of Menashe were
right.
actually present in Chronicles.
Right, right. So the portrayal of Menashe that we're more familiar with, it comes from Kings, and
sure.
Chronicles is ignored, but and usually the rabbis ignore it also. But this, I'm arguing, is one case in where they picked up on it. Yeah.
So from the sections in the Yerushalmi that you didn't get a chance to mention, but that you boxed in here, it seems like the missing is where the elephant.
Yeah. Right.
The malice.
Yep.
I'm wondering if the Yerushalmi is theoretically closer to the origin of this text. Why are we missing some of those key elements?
Ah, okay, that's right. I was looking for it in the translation, but it's not there. Right, it's in the Hebrew and Aramaic, in the back of the Bavli text, in the original. Well, that's precisely my point. I don't know. I mean, there are all of these situations where stuff that is going around or originating or passing through the Palestinian rabbi's back door, okay. So, for example, Josephus. Josephus is, Eusebius knows a tremendous amount, a church father in the 4th century, knows a tremendous amount of Josephus, but the Palestinian Talmud hardly knows him at all. Okay, I'm not talking about name, but even the motifs that are found in Josephus. Virtually all of them...
The Midrashim, though, include a lot of traditions, interpretive traditions that Josephus has, Philo as well. But.
There's some. But they're not just from Josephus. I'm talking about things that they only could have gotten from Josephus. Okay, most of those parallels, and I'm not the first to say this, are found, picked up in the Bavli, and it's like this for so many different things. Why exactly the Palestinian Talmud and the Midrashim from the land of Israel don't pick up on that stuff, it didn't reach them, that's something that I'm trying to find an answer to, and if you have an explanation, I would love to hear it. Probably make a great dissertation. Yes?
Could it be possibly that while they were closer to the original source, they were tabooed because people knew who the source was, they didn't want to use it, but then as time kept on going, it became popular myth, and so it was appropriate to be able to use it.
Well, Peter Schaeffer, in his book Jesus in the Talmud, makes that argument about Christianity, but specifically about portrayals of Jesus. It's the same thing, where all of these sources are in the Bavli, where Jesus is portrayed several times, many times, well, not quite many times, but... a decent number of times, and hardly at all, again, in the Palestinian rabbinic literature. And his claim, which I'm not entirely happy with, his claim is that in Palestine they had to watch what they said because, the Christians were much more in their face as opposed to the situation in Babylonia where there weren't so many Christians and the Christians weren't as powerful, so therefore the rabbis could say whatever they wanted to. It makes a good deal of sense, but I'm not totally satisfied with it. Yeah.
Picking up on what you just said, which I think is interesting, I don't know if this is a paraphrase or something, a spin on it, but the reason for not talking about it is by the very act of citing sources that were within that close culture, might in one way have popularized them, made them more accessible to the very individuals they didn't want to make it too accessible to, which is, if you will, that taboo. I like that.
Okay. Some of them are so vile and so disgusting that that is hard. The stuff that the rabbis do with Jesus' life.
Oh, well. let's not go there.
And is there a last comment or question? So now is the opportunity to purchase copies of Richard's book at a significant discount.
Yes.
$35 paid to the order, either cash
That's a discount.
Or check paid to the author pay the order of the author.
Can I send?
Thank you for coming, and look for other books sponsored by the library.
Okay, fine. No, it's much, much worse than...
Oh, no, I saw the price.
The price in Amazon is much...
$65. No, but I saw on the sheet, it said $65.
Yeah, right.
$35.
Well, but the sheet...
$35, right? $35?
Yeah, $35.
We're paying you or him?
I guess you're paying me.
Well, to the author, you know?
That's why, you know, oh, I just wish I had...
This month, let's write the date on this.
Sure, sure.
Get a pen.
Well, talk to him, we're not...
Yeah, no, but I just mentioned...
I can see if I have...
Oh, because that's...
Ah, here's a five. Okay.
It's too bad you don't take debit cards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the check you made out to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Richard Kalman.
Yeah, K-A-L-M-I-N. Oh, yeah. Okay.
K-A, sorry.
K-A-L-M-I-N.
Good. I can even do it tonight and drop it off tomorrow.
Okay. Just write the date and sign it.
Okay. What is the date anyway?
The 22nd.
Second.
Just sign it. Just for fun. Yeah, I can sell it on Amazon for twice the amount.
Right. On eBay, right? Sure.
Thank you.
Even bandages,
by the way.
Yeah, no, I know. Great talk. Thank you. I just want to say that was fascinating. Oh. It's a whole other world.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Right.
Thanks a lot for coming.
Will you do one for former students?
Sure.
Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, if you remember it, I didn't know. Well, you know, it's been a while.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Thank you.
But I like things that, you know, get your mind thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of deuteriums. I already have my topic. One thing at a time. How's it going?
Good.
How are you?
I appreciate it. And I'll get it off tonight or tomorrow morning, as the case may be, you know, same way.
Working at HSBC Bank.
Okay.
Thank you very much. That was interesting. It's, again, you know, I just keep thinking of the...
What are you doing?
There's so much cross-cultural turmoil going on. Think
right.
about it. It was like fermenting.
Yeah.
Look how much it produced.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
When you think about it, three different religions, a main religions.
I don't know.
Right.
Because we're not talking about, you know, you talked about Manichaeism.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for coming.
$35.
Can I also ask?
Right?
Okay.
I can never resist a book. That's the problem. You know, right now, all my personal property is in storage.
Remind me of your name. Matt Goldstone.
Yeah, you got to hear this, though. I have, you know, the letter legal size boxes, 162 of them are filled with books.
There are worse things to own in life.
Right? You bet your... Well, sometimes I wonder about my cats, if they're worse or better than. Couldn't live without either. The books are the cats.
Yeah, well, hopefully the cats aren't in storage. Hopefully you keep them.
No, sometimes I like to put them in deep freeze.
Fair. Oh, that's mine.
Me.
Okay. That's yours.
Oh, actually, I want to hear something funny on that story.
Congratulations on it.
Let's just put
okay.
it
I think there's anything to
one of
the fact that this whole story is introduced with a write-down about Mehilat Yuchsin that has Ish Ploni Mamzer Meishet Ish Shvepi.
I think it might. The only thing is, I have no idea then what to do with the Mishnat Rebbe Eliezer.
What does that mean?
It's Kavanaki. Well, I know the way it's interpreted. It's interpreted to mean that the halacha always goes according with to him. He doesn't say much, but when he says it, it counts. But I can't, for the life of me, think of a Christian slant on that. But you're right. It's very... it's tantalizing to think of that it might be.
Okay. So what are the good girls?
How much relationship do you think there is with these and Jesus within the Talmud and like books like Talmud and things like that? Is there, do you think that there's like this general just like myths flying around that were then put into
scripture? Well, there's a lot in Toldot Yeshu that Toldot Yeshu was an extremely popular book. Yes. So when you're talking about that, then those kinds of books, especially when they're not kind of controlled by learned scribes, but rather they kind of get out to the populace, they take on incredible life of their own, such as there are so many different versions of Toldot Yeshu. But interestingly, they're starting to study it, and Michael Sokoloff has an article in a book called Toldot Yeshu that's edited by Peter Schaefer and others, and he argues that there's an Aramaic manuscript of Toldot Yeshu, which is good Babylonian Aramaic, and there's a lot. He claims that it goes back to Amoraic times.
Mm-hmm. Is that generally accepted, or?
It's too new of a theory to have really been discussed. Mm-hmm. But he's the expert. He wrote the latest dictionary on it.
Also, the other question would be when you make an argument that like this is referring to someone else, is that did the people who understood that, as in, was that, would that have been something that was like commonly?
You mean that Yeshayahu is Yeshu?
And then the question is, if everyone would understand it, then why hide it?
Right.
Why not?
Unless you may say it's a later change. There was sometimes that they changed the name.
Well, I think that they wanted to make use of this story, which is why they kept the figure of Yeshayahu.
Okay.
And I don't know how many people picked up on this. I mean, the fact is that,
okay, great.
You know, as far as I know, I'm the first person to say this. So they hit it pretty well.
Yeah.
That's an excellent question, and it really goes to the heart of when you produce a work of art, kind of it leaves your hands and you can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that when it was first produced, and first handed down orally, that people were aware of it, but eventually, time and distance, it was eventually forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think that within rabbinic literature, there is a time when you just have upset rabbis just kind of, not even to say something to everyone else, just expressing their own frustrations at certain things? It's not necessarily meant to educate, it's just them treating it as their own personal journal.
It could be, but
it's a hard thing to determine.
Right, but a lot of it is just so carefully crafted, mm-hmm. That's not...
Or edited.
Right, yeah, and so that it...
Do you want us to take this to the
office?
Sure,
I'll come get
it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So that it's not something that they just kind of dashed off. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're clearly taking some time to come up with this.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I mean, I think that the Talmud is rabbinic by rabbis for rabbis.
Yeah.
So they are, I think, clearly getting lots of entertainment out of this and getting lots of frustration off of their chest.
Mm-hmm. May we have your autograph?
Sure.
Referring to put this in the library of Congregation Agudath Israel.
Oh, great. Call. Okay. Could you remind me of your names?
Well, it's not for us, though. It's for the show.
Oh.
So for Congregation Agudath with a TH.
Okay, should I write that in English?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. More of them will read it.
Israel, right?
Right. It's no way consistent.
Uh-huh.
That's great.
It's an amazing congregation that has people there who would appreciate it.
Now I'll know how to say hello to you in the elevator. I'm Debbie Miller.
Oh, okay.
Nice to
Clifford
meet you.
Miller.
Hi.
Thank you, and Yashiko.
Thank you very much.
That was very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad you could make it.
Yeah. Sorry I came late. I just came out of work and I grabbed the bike.
All right. Well, you know, it wasn't. You came in plenty
of time. Right. Yeah, no. It was funny. I was going to ask the same question about why wouldn't you find it more applicably in the
mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Very interesting.